Justin.
I'm Kathy.
I'm Tom.
And this is Comicsverse.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to the very first episode of the Comicsverse X-Men podcast. As a reminder, you can find us on the web at comicsverse.com, on Twitter at twitter.com/comicsverse, on Tumblr at comicsverse.tumblr.com, and youtube.com/comicsverse TV. Please remember to check out our YouTube videos. We have some people at Comicsverse working really hard to bring you the latest video reviews and interviews at Comic Cons. Please leave us some comments to let us know what you think, and we'd love to get back to you. This is a very special podcast because it's our first X-Men only podcast here at Comicsverse. And it's so new that we don't even have a name for it.
Don't even have a name, but maybe we'll come up with one in the next hour or so.
Exactly. And if you can think of a good name for the Comicsverse X-Men podcast, why don't you email us at info@comicsverse.com and say, hey, I have a great name for your podcast.
Or if you're under, 32 years old, you can tweet. You can tweet at us. We're at Comicsverse on Twitter.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
We're also on YouTube at youtube.com/comicsverse TV.
Make a YouTube video pitching us your name for our X-Men only Comicsverse podcast.
And then crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Just kidding.
Facebook, we're on Facebook.
Facebook.com/comicsverse. And we have a Facebook group, which we're all a part of. Facebook.com/groups/comicsverse TV. So feel free to join our group and say, hey, I have a good idea for a name for you guys, and it's not your current one.
Yes, we will be happy to get your feedback.
Right? Okay, so without any further ado, it's time to introduce the X-Men only Comicsverse podcasters.
Yeah.
Starting with Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hi, guys.
All the way from UK. Sorry, not to interrupt you there, but Tom's all the way from UK, and we liked him so much that we're using Skype for the first time to talk to someone far away, as opposed to having everyone right here in this room. So that just goes to show how much we really want Tom to be a part of this.
Woo. Nice to meet everyone. My name's Tom. I'm an old school X-Men fan from the UK. Got into the comics when I was a child and been absolutely hooked pretty much ever since. The only era I sort of skipped was the Morrison era. I wasn't a fan there.
I love Morrison era.
Sorry?
I love the Morrison era.
That's for another podcast.
Another podcast.
Nonetheless, I'm an old school X-Men fan, absolutely hooked to the characters. That's the thing I've always loved with the X-Men, is the characters have always seemed so 3D to me, so solid. And that's what's always drawn me to the characters. I felt as though there were people who I knew, who I saw grow up, who I saw go through all these different arcs and journeys that really resonated to me all the way through my childhood, teenage years, and even now into my 30s. I contribute to a large number of blogs on the internet. Comicsverse has had a few of my articles. There's also been Mamoose Comics, Comic Book Herald, and I also work with a couple of Facebook groups on the X-Men. So I'm definitely all over the place if you want to look up X-Men stuff.
What I like is that you're the moderator of that huge X-Men page. It has like 50,000 friends or whatever it is. 50,000 likes. 50,000 likes.
Yes, we've got a very good team with that page.
Yeah.
So there's quite a wide range of people who each contribute their own specialities, who each discuss things that are close to them. I admit mine tends to be, as much as anything, promoting blogs and internet articles that I've found, just because I love researching. So I'll find an interview here with a comic book writer that gives me something, an article over here that's got some interesting stuff to it. So I contribute a lot of those, really.
That's great. And I think, that's what a part of the legitimacy that Tom adds is that, you wouldn't be the moderator or administrator of the X-Men group unless you knew a lot about X-Men.
Yeah.
So I think that's a great thing. So what about you, Kathy? Everyone knows Kathy because Kathy's the breakout star of the Comicsverse podcast. Read the Dark Phoenix Saga podcast when you did some amazing pirouettes.
Right. But I have headphones on now, so that's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen tonight. It's not going to happen. Yeah.
No, maybe.
Tell our audience, relax. Right. Relax, chill the F out. She is not doing pirouettes again.
Please relax, audience.
Take a Xanax and call me tomorrow.
Okay. So you might know me from the Comics First podcast, but I started reading comics long before that. I have two older brothers and one younger brother, all really into comics. and I would borrow theirs because Barbie comics were boring, and I liked the X-Men since then. Eventually, years later, I went to Columbia, which is where I met Justin, and in that time, I also had the opportunity to intern at the Marvel office here in New York City, and I was lucky enough to be placed as an editorial intern in the X office with the editors of the various X-Men titles. So that was an amazing opportunity and probably the vertex of my entire life. It's all downhill from here. So here I am today.
Can I just say, I am so jealous.
Yeah, beat that other podcast. We have a freaking X-Men office intern.
You'll have to find one of the other ones that they get every year.
Yeah, right? Yeah, good luck with that, too. Good luck on getting one who can speak as good as Kathy and who can do pirouettes.
Yeah. I really want to see these pirouettes now.
Yeah, you know, oh man, Tom wants to see a pirouette, Kathy.
I don't mean, yeah, maybe after the podcast once we go off air.
You know, one thing that I want to talk about before we start talking about Giant Size X-Men 1, which is what this podcast is going to be about, is what is going to make this different other than the legitimacy? Oh, I didn't even talk about myself yet. Holy shit.
Oh, yeah. Justin, what are you doing here talking about X-Men?
What am I doing here talking about X-Men? Well, I've been an X-Men fan since I was six, since Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, the X-Men Adventure, got me hooked. And I was like, who are these people? And I forced my mom to buy me the comic book. And ever since then, I was hooked until I was 14. I thought I was too cool for school and didn't want to read them. Started reading them again when I was 27, a story which you guys know all too well, but we'll tell you all later, that got me hooked back on comics again. Since then, I've taken two comic book classes at Columbia University, written a few papers on them, and I started an X-Men Nation website, a website called X-Men Nation that was a fan site for X-Men that morphed into Comicsverse. So that's what we have now. And, Comicsverse has that deeper analytical edge, that in-depth edge that we have when we talk about comics, and I hope that this podcast will have that when we talk about X-Men comics too, because there's a lot of heavy things going on in X-Men comics, and they might not tackle the issues as directly as other comics, but man, I mean, we were disagreeing a little bit about it earlier, but I thought this comic, Giants as X-Men 1, was chock full of lots of emotional stuff that was going on. So we're going to debate and discuss that later, I'm sure. First, what's going to make this podcast different than some other ones? Because some other podcasts are going to try to get you with humor. They're going to try to get you with flashy sounds and really cool sound effects and... and things like that. And so, you know, what do we have to offer? So what do we have to offer, Kathy?
Well, we were talking about this before, and I think what we've all kind of agreed on is the way to describe it is that as difficult as it can be to talk about X-Men with a straight face, we're all just going to lead from the heart, and we're going to talk about X-Men as true fans and with all of the, you know, genuine melodramatic emotion of a Claremont X-Men monologue. We're going to talk about what we love about the comics. And that's what's going to make us different.
I agree with that. I think, hey, I'm not going to go right up and say that Chris Claremont has probably had more of an effect on me in my life than probably any other human being, because I read so much X-Men comics growing up and I learned so much from them that I feel like part of my personality, or most of my personality, is what it is because I derived it from reading these books. And I think that Tom, would you agree with the same thing, that you were so deeply affected by them that, you know, part of the reason
without
why
doubt.
Yeah,
I admit that when I first got into them, it was in the early 90s with the animated series going on, but very quickly I found myself dipping back into the Claremont era, and I loved the way he fleshed the characters out, the depth he went to. You never had someone who was just one-dimensional when Chris Claremont was involved. He would always want them to be a 3D person with their own fears, their own journeys, their own stories, and that was very much what drew me to the X-Men.
Me too.
I think, Justin, you've pointed out before that, like, since Claremont had wanted to be an actor, like, you sort of identify with that desire to, like, I guess, want to give the characters motivation, like, make mm-hmm. them be characters that can be inhabited.
Yeah, I think what's so cool about what he did was, you know, say what you will about his writing being juvenile, and say what you will about his writing being...
bombastic, maybe?
Bombastic? That's a good Long word. I would never have used that word, but that's a good word. Say what you will about that, but I could imagine Storm being in this room right now. I could imagine her right here.
Yes.
You know, I can imagine any of these characters from Giant Size X-Men 1 being here. Some of them more angry than others, but yeah. I could definitely imagine them being here. I can imagine Rogue being here. I like what he did with Jean Grey. I can imagine her being here. I can imagine Cyclops being here. As much as I don't want him here, I can imagine him being here. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, he did such a great job with making them so real that it's not hard for me to imagine these things.
Yeah, and it makes sense to talk about Claremont here because Giant Size X-Men is sort of like the platform that he leapt from.
Right.
Yeah.
And he was still working at the X office at this time.
Yeah, he was already working there.
What was interesting, though, from that angle is how he took those characters, and sometimes he took them in completely different directions. So Wolverine's the classic example that the original idea had been the claws would be part of his gloves. Whereas under Claremont and Byrne, that became actually part of his arms, part of his skeletal structure. And it's just interesting the subtle way that he rewrote the ideas that were floating around at the time as well.
That is pretty interesting, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did not know that. So why do you guys think Giant Size X-Men 1 is a good starting place for a brand new X-Men podcast? Or do you think it is, or do you disagree?
Well, first of all, I think it's quite appropriate because it's the anniversary next year.
Oh.
So it's big times coming up for this particular issue. Next year, there's lots of rumours about different things that are going to go on to celebrate the anniversary of Giant Size X-Men. So it's a very fitting time to be looking at it anyway. In reality, though, leaving that aside, it'd still be a good time. Giant Size X-Men 1 was the relaunch of the X-Men. It was the thing that took this series that, yeah, it had some cool concepts, some good characters, but it just had never really hit the big time. And it took this concept and suddenly launched it onto a completely different scale. Transformed the X-Men. Utterly transformed them. One of the things that I've just been thinking about as we were talking today, actually, mm-hmm. was this was actually a key time for comics and for Marvel in particular. One other big famous event that's symbolic of the 1970s in comics is actually the death of Gwen Stacy.
Yes.
Still voted as the most iconic Marvel moment of all time.
Wow.
And it's just interesting to take a step back and think this was a time when comics were changing. This was a time when readers were starting to get used to plots that had meaning, that had impact, and when writers actually took a chance. And in a way, Giant Size X-Men is very much a chance. It's this international team put together at a time when, frankly, the world did not seem particularly international. You have, I mean, I think one of the ones that really stands out is Colossus from Russia.
Absolutely.
At the time, with the Cold War heating up, the enemy of the United States of America, where this comic was selling. And it's an incredibly risky shot. And that's just one of the things that stands out straight away, is this was a time when comics were taking chances. And when they paid off big time.
I actually completely agree with what you just said about Colossus and the enemy of the United States at the time being such a important part of this comic. And not only is it the enemy at the time, but, you know, there's also a character from Japan. World War II was 30 years before. Tensions were still running high in some cases. You also have the Native Americans. The 70s had an important period where Native American rights were very were integral, and I think that having a Native American character speaks to that. And I think the same thing when you go and talk about a character like Storm. Kathy, on the other hand, had a major problem. She had a major problem with how Storm was portrayed, and she did not think that it was positive, because here you have all these, what she referred to as, you know, you have two white men writing about savages who are naked, who are asking their goddess in 1975 to make rain. And she didn't really find that to be a positive depiction of Africans. Whereas I saw it as, okay, here you have this woman who we find out later is both African and African-American, who is being worshipped as a goddess, which is significantly different than how African-American were being treated in the United States at the time, and I'm sure in many other countries at the time as well.
I think there's a bit of a sort of a balance in this comic that's quite a difficult one, because on the one hand, it's doing something really radical in presenting characters who you'd never see before in comics. Mm-hmm. Certainly not as heroes. But on the other hand, it does indulge in a heck of a lot of stereotypes. It's as though the writers have started along quite a powerful and dramatic journey, but they haven't quite got there yet. And that, I think, is the key thing. You've got to judge this as a piece of its time.
Yes.
So it was incredible having an African hero.
Yes.
That doesn't mean that the writers really understood what it meant to have an African hero.
I think.
There's a balance there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the character they might have misunderstood the most might be Thunderbird, because here you have this character, and his only power is to be super Native American. So he's a super Indian. You know, he can track, and he has super strength and super heightened senses, and it's a little, if I can use the word shady, it's a little shady.
Yes, absolutely.
To say the least. But you're right, there's a balance that doesn't discount the fact that here is a Native American character in your face in comics that you did not see a year ago when they were reprinting old X-Men comics.
I mean, for me as a Brit, one of the ones that was interesting is Banshee. I mean, leaving aside the fact that in the actual mythology, Banshees are always female, you've got the interesting fact that they've chosen to take an Irish character out of X-Men history and make him a major player. And that's significant because at this point in time, the IRA were just really heating things up. There was massive tension building. So when an American turned on the news, all they'd ever see were terrorist activities associated with Ireland. Again, it's a remarkably controversial thing, however stereotypical the character may be.
And, you know, not only are these stereotypes, but we're saying that, hey, these stereotypes are also heroes. And they're part of this group called the X-Men, who are extraordinary people who Professor X talks about in the beginning as being more than human. I almost want to use the word metahuman, but I don't want to make it a DC thing. But who are, and when we say more than human, who rise above the dark parts of human nature.
And I think that actually fits really nicely with the international aspect, because they're giving the feeling that anyone from anywhere can be part of that, can rise above that. To me, one of the scenes that really stands out in this comic has always been when Professor Xavier is recruiting Nightcrawler.
Yes.
And Nightcrawler says, "Can you make me normal?" And the first time I ever read Giant Size X-Men, it was actually a novel version was published in the 90s.
Yeah.
And it really got into Kurt Wagner's head at that point. And just had Xavier turning around and saying, looking at the mob and saying, "Do you want to be?" And the idea there was just so powerful, that the normal was to be completely overwhelmed by your hatred and your fear, but that anyone anywhere from any culture, any country, could transcend that and be much more than human. I don't think the remarkable thing about any of these characters was that they were mutants. It was that they were willing to work together, that they were willing to unite. That was what really made them remarkable and what made them heroes.
And that's what Kathy will talk about in a little bit when she goes into her close reading, about something that this comic may be about, is about working together as a team, you know, uniting over all these differences to work together as a team and accomplish things you wouldn't be able to accomplish on your own. And I think, you know, that's a powerful message. But, you know, like you said, that scene with Nightcrawler in the beginning is so powerful, and it comes up, the word normal comes up a few times. Another time it comes up is when, to jump ahead after the origin stories, I call them the origin stories. They're not really origin stories, but they're, you know, the origin story portion of the book. To when
appearance stories.
Right, yeah. Oh, he says, "My eyes are normal. They're powerless." And that was interesting to me, because is he saying that to be normal is to be powerless? Is that what he's saying ultimately? That to be different is to have power? And if he's saying that, in what context does he mean it?
Of course, just as a bit of humor to it, mm-hmm. in traditional 1970s comic, Cyclops isn't actually saying that to Xavier. He's saying that to nobody.
Oh, you're right.
There is nobody around at that second. And to make it even better, he then follows on. Did you hear me, world? I can't. Huh? And you're just there like, so he thinks the whole world is listening? It's brilliant 1970s style comics.
It is right that those soliloquies that the characters go through when they're talking to themselves are amazing. And fortunately and unfortunately, they don't happen anymore.
I always felt, though, that quite often they express so much of their character. And to be honest, I counted it as a bit of a breaking the fourth wall moment, sort of like Deadpool routinely does. Cyclops, at that 1 second, I think, is addressing the readers rather than anyone else. Hence, did you hear me, world? Looking out straight out of the page.
Yeah.
I actually see that as him looking to us as he says it.
Wow. No, that's pretty cool. That's a really cool way to think about it, too. But this issue of being normal comes up a few times. And even though he doesn't say it with Storm, Storm is definitely not normal when this comic starts. She's being worshipped as a goddess. And he's saying, hey, give all that up and come to a world that hates and fears you. It's like what Kathy was saying, that Professor Xavier is promising them different things. He's saying to her, come into a world where there are normal people and you won't be treated like that. Should we go through a couple more of the origin stories?
Okay, certainly.
You know, I don't know how to feel about Wolverines.
It's an interesting one because I don't think Marvel have known how to feel about that one.
Right.
It's the origin that I think has been the most completely rewritten. I don't know if you've read the first major Marvel plotline called Original Sin, but a few years back it was a crossover between X-Men Legacy and Wolverine Origins, and it rewrote it. It wrote it as that Wolverine had actually been tasked to kill Xavier, and Xavier essentially wiped his memory of that, and a lot of Wolverine's memory blocks actually came from Professor X, of all people.
Okay.
But it's just interesting that Marvel felt the need, that Mike Carey in particular felt the need to completely rewrite how that scene plays out.
I wonder why. I wonder if it wasn't chock full of all those great things those other stories were in this portion of the comic. But what I did like about it was, he's saying that he can't live with this bureaucracy, and Xavier is promising him a way around that. You know, it's funny because it's the part about America I'm not so proud of, which is saying, you know, F the government. I'm going to show you the government is the problem, and I'm going to take away this obstacle so that you can do whatever you need to do in order to pursue what you want, whether that be good or bad. And I think that's both a blessing and a curse. And in this case, one can argue that it's good or bad in Wolverine's case, but I think that it ultimately goes to that value.
One of the most bizarre scenes in that whole intro story is Wolverine. It's actually really symbolic. Wolverine cutting the guy's tie and shirt buttons off. It's like, what? But it's symbolic. The tie, the blazer done up, symbolic of this stiff, starchy, structured life. And so Wolverine, I'm resigning my commission effective immediately. And he's not just cutting it because he's got a vendetta against ties. Mm. He's doing it because it's symbolic of the decision he's making.
It's like Wolverine, the animal, cannot be caged.
Interestingly enough, one of the ideas that they played around with in these mid-70s was the idea that Wolverine was never actually a man at all. He was actually a mutated Wolverine.
I remember that, yeah.
Hence, you have this hilarious scene at one point where they're dealing with, believe it or not, leprechauns, where Wolverine says, I don't believe in leprechauns, and the leprechaun responds, well, we don't believe in talking Wolverines, neither. there's a bit more to that scene than it looks at first glance. But yeah, at the time, Marvel hadn't really fixed on just what Wolverine was in the first place.
It took them a while to abandon that concept. And I think one of the reasons they did abandon it was because they did the same thing with Spider-Woman, who was supposed to be a mutated spider. The fans freaked out, and then they went back and they changed it. So they ultimately decided not to go through with that with Wolverine, which I'm kind of glad that they didn't. More than kind of.
Although, again, that got sort of a revisit in the early 2000s. They had a plot line. You might remember the very controversial villain Romulus, where it was revealed that there was this race of not quite humans, but a separate strand of humanity who were more savage, who typically had healing factors, Wolverine and Sabretooth being preeminent among them. So Wolverine wasn't of the normal strand of humanity at all, was the idea that came up. Marvel pretty much forgotten it again,
yeah,
because it really annoyed the fans, quite frankly. It was one of those ideas that I think they looked back on and thought, we wish we'd never done that.
Most likely. And what about Storm's story here? The first thing that I think about when I look at this is how beautiful the art is.
Yes.
The art's absolutely amazing, I think.
Yes, absolutely. It's iconic imagery, isn't it? It's some of the best that you see from the 70s all the time. And it's an origin that I've seen redone so many times and with homages in so many issues.
And there's just something about this one in particular sticks into my memory. Whenever I think of Storm, I think of this origin story.
Yes.
Because it's just, you know, it's short. It's been, I'm not sure if it's been retcon, but it's been redone, as you said, and as Kathy said. But there's just something about it that's so iconic, like you said, that brings your mind to it all the time. There's just something about her, too, whether it's the white hair and the blue eyes, that is just so striking. You know, you don't forget Storm after you see her. And the fact that she's nude is a big deal. Not in so much that she's in a sexual sense, but she's natural. And when Professor X again asks her to come to this world, there's a wonderful issue of Classic X-Men of one of the B stories. I'm not sure if Claremont wrote it or not, but Jean Grey takes Storm out, and Storm changes from her X-Men costume and is completely nude. And Jean Grey is like, you can't do that. You know, this is New York City. And she buys her all these clothes. And it just goes to show how Storm is so, how being natural is such a part of her personality. I really like that about her, I have to say. And it's something that sticks in my head all the time about her. There's another panel of her here where he tells her, you are no goddess, Aurora. You're a mutant. And the close-up of her face as he's talking to her with the rain in the background, totally iconic,
yes,
too.
Yes, I think for me, the image that always sticks with me for Storm is that intro scene,
yes,
where on the second page featuring her, she's there with the winds flurrying around her. And frankly, it looks like the winds are almost a cape that she's wearing.
Yes.
And I love that creative idea that this is a woman who wears nature.
Yes.
Almost like a garment. So it's not the case that she's not wearing a costume. She is wearing a costume. The whole world is her costume. Mm. The natural weather and everything. And I just think there's something quite beautiful about that concept.
Absolutely. Brings me back to how I used to think about Storm, I guess. Because, you know, like you said about the X-Men, it's how much the characters have changed on these journeys. And Storm has changed quite a bit.
Yes.
You know, she's become, I don't want to say she's become American, but she's become Westernized. And, and she's adopted Western culture. So it's amazing to see where she came from, and it reinvigorates the character a little bit to come back and to read this. And I think everyone should read this issue. If you read X-Men, you absolutely should read this issue, because, you know, this is the origin story of your favorite characters, period.
This is the groundwork.
Exactly. So what about Sunfire here?
For me, with Storm, one of the key things that Marvel tried to do in the 2000s was through her marriage to Black Panther. It was very badly handled from a narrative viewpoint, very rushed into. But I think I understood what they were trying to do, which was to actually de-Westernize her a little.
Yes.
Bring her back to that African context. And I respect Marvel for trying that. I don't think it worked because they did it in the wrong way.
They did, yeah.
But I do think they had some guts in trying to take the character back to that.
Well, it's like they made her a princess, which I thought was bizarre because,
a queen,
yeah. And I thought that served to dehumanize her rather than humanize her. And it took her away from us, from the reader, as opposed to bringing her towards us. And I thought that was a shame.
At the same time, I do recommend checking out some of those Black Panther comics, because at some points, Storm did some pretty incredible things with her powers. I mean, during the Civil War era, the Black Panther tie-in actually had Storm beat a clone of Thor.
Wow.
Seriously. She managed to beat a clone of Thor with sheer skill and intelligence and in using her powers in very intriguing ways that I'd never seen in comics before. So I do recommend having a check at those. You may not like the romance side with T'Challa, but at the same time, if you keep an eye to how those writers used Storm and her powers, it's actually really quite interesting.
It is, and let's not forget that Storm is one of the only people who could use Thor's hammer.
Yes. Well, sort of. She actually got a duplicate of Thor's hammer made by Loki.
Oh, so it wasn't the real deal.
Wasn't the real deal, I'm afraid.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, see.
Although, interestingly enough, during, I forget which one, possibly Contest of Champions, Storm and Thor had to go head to head. Thor won.
Oh.
Because he kissed her and she swooned.
Oh, okay. Interesting, to say the least. What do you think about Xavier's courtship of Sunfire into the X-Men?
Let's just have a look at that again. Well, I've heard a few comedy descriptions of that one. That's the one I've read the most spoofs of. The idea that Sunfire starts a sentence and he's currently in his robe. And then he basically says to Xavier, hold on a minute, let's go out, just give me a minute, let me get changed, let's go outside, and I'll finish my sentence. And it's a brilliant scene that is so typical of comics at the time, that the wording would be there to evoke a sense of drama at times.
Yeah.
But that sometimes when you looked at it and actually thought a little bit, it really didn't make any sense at all as a scene.
That's so true, yeah. It really doesn't. One thing that we learned about from reading Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics is closure. And closure being the gutter between panels, and that being what we have to imagine happens between those panels. And if you look at the panel with Xavier talking to Sunfire in his robe, and then Sunfire in full costume, that's asking for a lot to happen during that period of closure. And maybe a little bit too much now that I'm looking at it after talking about it with you.
Particularly when he's carrying on his sentence in the next one.
You mean you don't carry on your sentences wearing one outfit and then finish them in another? Wait, hold on, I have to change clothes. No, I'm kidding. Although he didn't even say that. He would just start changing. So I guess that's like...
I hope he left the room so he didn't do it in front of Xavier either.
But moving on to Colossus a little bit, something that struck me was the use of the color red here. And I wasn't sure if that was on purpose or if that was a tie to the USSR. But he's got those red pants on. The tractor is red. And one thing that I really, really enjoyed was this... his transition from being human and having human skin into being Colossus with the adamantium skin. And they have this panel in the middle of just just energy flowing from his body and the air crackling. And what that does is that adds a lot of time, that elongates the moment. So it makes this transformation so much more powerful, both to the reader and to Colossus. And I think that that's a pretty cool thing.
It's an interesting power set to give him, particularly given at the time. It's just occurred to me to do a quick check as to when the phrase the Iron Curtain was first being used. Because that would be quite appropriate. The man from Russia is the one who turns to metal.
Right? Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
You can see the amusing little bit of fun that Marvel are having with that character. I think the thing that I find enjoyable about it, though, is that this single intro scene introduces a lot more as well, a lot more than just the basics. So you've got the fact that it's his sister, Ilyana, who he's rescuing, who will, under Chris Claremont, become such a major character.
Oh, under many writers, yeah.
Well, yes. One of my criticisms of this scene, though, I have to say, is the fact that he's Pyotr Nikolaevich Rasputin. I don't like the fact that Marvel, with this character, took the surname Rasputin to denote the mutant, because you could argue that it's linking back to the famous monk in the First World War, in the time of the First World War. And in fact, Marvel eventually did make that link. I personally think Colossus would work much stronger not connected in that kind of way.
I would like to know why they chose that name. Why Rasputin? What do they want to evoke in the reader from by choosing it? And, you know, it's controversial to say the least.
Yes. My instinct, this is just an instinct, mm-hmm. but my instinct is that there's a subtle implication that running through history there have always been these mutants. I mean, when you look into Rasputin, he's a fascinating character, so I can understand the temptation to try and flesh him out.
Yeah.
If you look into his death, for example, the fact that however hard they tried, it took so many attempts to kill him. The guy must have had a healing factor to rival Wolverine's.
Wow.
And that's real history. So to me, it was a subtle attempt to link him in to aspects of real world history and to try and embed the concept of mutants just a little bit more into the real world. Unfortunately, because that's a character who's so beyond the everyday in the first place, I actually think it fails as that kind of attempt, particularly because I actually think Rasputin works better. You could potentially use the character as a mystic figure rather than tying him to mutants. And ironically, that's what Marvel in the 2000 eventually did in the Colossus Bloodlines series. They had it that while Colossus and Illyana were Rasputin's ancestors, they were just mutants, whereas Rasputin was a sorcerer. Oh. And I think magic, they had tread the boundaries between the two. I read one interview with Chris Claremont that said that's where he got the idea of Illyana becoming magic, when he thought of the surname Rasputin. So undoubtedly, that choice of surname had a massive impact on the future of the characters.
So interesting. And I think that, I don't know, I think conversations like these are good to have, because there's going to be people listening to this podcast and they're going to go out there and they're going to start looking this stuff up. And I think that that's great. It's going to lead you to learn more about history and make some connections of your own when it comes to this. And that's what comics, and that's what specifically X-Men comics, and that's what this X-Men comic is all about. And I think that that's great. Now, I'm not sure if I said it yet, but one character a lot of people had problems with was Thunderbird. Have we discussed that in this iteration?
Only a little, just to say that he's very stereotyped.
Yeah, whoa.
He's like the embodiment of stereotype.
It's like having, I can say this because I'm Puerto Rican, but it's like having a Puerto Rican mutant who's really good at gun wielding and eating empanadas. You know, it's like it takes it really far. You know, it's like I don't, you know, it's like it's like as if I could shoot plantains out of my hands or something like that. You know, it's too cultural. It's, you know, and it didn't make me feel uncomfortable until someone explained it to me. And then now that I'm looking at it for like the fifth or sixth or seventh or eighth or ninth or tenth time, you know, it's watching him run after this buffalo is weird.
It is, as we said, while the comic does celebrate diversity, it doesn't go all the way. It doesn't realize that it's dealing with stereotypes quite often. And so it deals with them in quite an unsubtle way. I think there's a way to do these stereotypes where you flag up, hold on a minute, what we're saying here is ridiculous, but here it's played straight.
Yeah.
It's played as though the stereotype is what you'd expect. And yeah, it just sits very uneasily with me.
It does, and it goes, it's a limitation of the writers, and it's a limitation of the writers as product of their times.
Although I do love one bit of his dialogue. It just makes me laugh so much.
Which
I'm
one?
Not sure it's supposed to be funny, but when he tells Xavier, "And you can stuff a cactus, Custer." And it's just like, oh gosh, that's cringeworthy.
Do you know Thunderbird, not in this issue, but in the issue where they start fighting Baron Von's whatever, he says one of my favorite lines, which is he gets into a fight with Cyclops and he's like, "I'll rearrange your face." I always like that one. I always wanted to get into a fight with someone so I could say that, but I'm just not a violent man.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So he did have his moments.
He did have his moments, yeah. I mean,
very few, because he didn't exactly last long. But.
He was like, he did not last long at all. I'm trying to come up with some like pop culture equivalent of someone who did not last that long, but.
Although, interestingly, Marvel did give him quite a nice resurrection plot in the. I think it was in the late 2000s. Did you ever read the Chaos War comics.
No.
But the idea was at that time that the dead were rising. It was a very common thing in comics at the time. Necrotia was going on. Chaos War was going on. There was another plot in Astonishing X-Men with the dead rising. And Thunderbird actually had a really key part to play in the Chaos War X-Men miniseries.
Did not know that. And I knew he was in Necrotia, but I didn't know about the Chaos War.
Yeah, it was actually pretty much, I would say, he was the star of the show. Played him really well. I really recommend it because the writers then tried to play a little bit with the concept to make him a bit more, shall we say, original.
Okay, I like that. I mean, and I love Warpath. He's one of my favorite characters, hands down.
Yes.
I know people have a problem with him, too, in the same way they have a problem with Thunderbird, but, man, I just thought he was so great in that Rise and Fall of Shi'ar Empire and the Messiah Complex.
Story.
Yeah, so I'm a big Warpath fan. I'm a fan of the Proudstar family, and, you know, it's good stuff. Although, you know, like we mentioned a few times, it starts off a little stereotypical and it makes you feel a little uncomfortable, but it's important to read nonetheless. We took some really good notes here. I'm just going to read these out loud because what else was happening in the world at the time, and this, you wrote down a lot of these things and so did I, but some things that were happening in the world at the time were second wave feminism in the 70s, which can be seen as being influencing Storm story in Giant Size X-Men. I talked earlier about rights for Native Americans, post-American racial segregation. Again, we're talking about Storm. I think it's post-World War II with a German character like Nightcrawler and then a Japanese character like Sunfire.
Yes.
You wrote here the first hints of globalization.
Yes, absolutely. The world was changing in the 1970s, changing quite dramatically. It was dividing into blocks a little bit at this time. So you had the USSR at one central block. You had what would eventually become the European Union. You had America. But above all this was the idea that nation states were less important, that it was about unity between some different countries. And at this stage, we weren't really at globalization yet because you had these blocks sort of very antagonistic towards one another. But realistically, I don't think globalization would have been possible without those first faltering steps.
Something else you got into was the Cold War and what it was like having America's enemy being this character, this General Giant character who, who's been called to join the X-Men, which I thought was great. And then you talked a little bit about this, but I wouldn't mind hearing you talk more about Banshee and what was going on in Ireland at the time.
Yes, I only know a little bit about it, but essentially the history of Britain, of England and Ireland has been fraught with a lot of difficulty and danger. In the 1970s, things got really, really bad. What geographers call separatist pressure was building up, and it was leading to enormous levels of conflict between England and Ireland. Ultimately, it led to the IRA's terrorist bombings in the UK, in the rest of the UK. But the conflict level was enormous. Interestingly enough, the IRA have always arguably had connections in America, where there's always been a strong Irish immigrant vote that supported them. So you've got some potential ties between the audience who'd be reading these comics and those groups. Just an interesting sort of historical aspect to it.
That's so true. That's so true. And a great point, I think. And that tends to be forgotten because I don't know. I can't speak to it now, but it's not a part of American news anymore, what's going on with Ireland. And
no. Well, it's quietened down a lot.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Peace process has gone brilliantly. And all credit, that's very much largely to do with some American presidents, as well as anything going on at this side of the Atlantic pond. Some American presidents did some real good.
Clinton being
really
one.
Helped calm tensions there. So, speaking as a Brit, thanks to America for that one.
Well, we have a lot to thank you for, like most notably the fact that we exist. So,
you're welcome.
So there's a lot of mutual thankfulness going on. What about the symbology of the old world needing rescue by the new world? This group that wasn't working for a myriad of reasons. It wasn't working in publishing. They didn't have good chemistry. They weren't popular. They needed to be saved by this brand new group of mutants who were international and who were different than they were. What does that mean?
Well, I think there's some interesting sides to that one. First of all, you've got the fact that this old group are all white. You know, let's be honest about it. There is no international aspect to that original team of X-Men at all.
Whatsoever, yeah.
Then you've got the fact that the old world is very distinctively rooted in the past. I mean, that's nowhere as obvious as when you look at Marvel Girl's costume. I'm sorry, but green miniskirt, the green suit, it screams 1960s.
Yes.
And everything about that team to me is representative of this is yesterday's news. And then they bring in this whole new world. And so you've got this idea that the old world has dropped itself in the deep end, has gone where it never should have gone. And the new world, this whole new international group has to come in. Tying into that is sort of one of the other points I've made to do with the Gaia hypothesis. I don't know how well up you are on geography, but I did a geography degree.
And oh, cool.
We did quite a bit of studying into James Lovelock's Gaia hypothesis. In 1974, he theorized that the whole world was essentially a single self-regulating organism, that everything in it is tied together. And when you take a step back, doesn't that sound rather like Krakoa? My instinct on it, I've got no evidence whatsoever, but my instinct is that Len Wein was tapping into that, that he'd actually looked and thought, well, if the world is a single organism, we're in a world with disease, volcanoes like Krakatoa, which is where he got the name Krakoa from, avalanches, all earthquakes, all these different natural epidemics. If the world is an organism, maybe it's a hostile one. And so set up in that backdrop, you've got the idea of the old world has walked itself into an absolute situation where the world is against it. And only by working together, by drawing international heroes together, grouping together as a team, can we actually overcome and survive this hostile world in which we live.
I think that's brilliant. And I wouldn't be surprised if that was part of how he came up with the idea of Krakoa, because you're right. It was on the consciousness of people who were thinking about science at the time.
Interestingly enough, in the early 2000s, James Lovelock revisited his hypothesis. I think it was 2004, if I remember right, The Revenge of Gaia. In that one, he took it almost in the same kind of direction. The idea he suggested was that through climate change, through pollution, man has become like a disease to the organism.
Yes, like a virus.
And so he argued that epidemics and natural disasters were like antibodies with which Gaia was fighting back.
Wow.
And you've almost got, you're veering very near to the idea of Krakoa when you're going there, really. It's quite interesting that science has mirrored comics in a way there.
That's so true. So this is the portion of this episode where we're going to get into what we like to call a close reading.
One of the things that we're always harping on after being students of comics is that it's important to pay attention to what makes comics as a medium different from other storytelling media. And so sometimes it's easy to talk about just the plot, and I mean, the plot's so much fun and it's so consuming that it's hard to talk about other things, but that is sort of missing what makes comics special and what makes it work really well. And so I thought that it would be cool to try an instance in Giant Size X-Men where the design of the pages really reflected what was going on in the story and also what the story was really about. So I have numbered pages in my version. I don't know if anyone else does, but yeah. Okay, so I'm on page 31. Which is right when Krakoa has emerged as a humanoid kind of fighty guy.
Mm-hmm.
and the X-Men are all sort of launching their special attack. So what we have, we're looking at one big panel at the top and then four small panels underneath. And in the big panel, we have the text that says, "Mere words could never begin to describe the sheer unbridled savagery of the battle that follows. So we won't even attempt it here," which is a cool way of saying, just look at the picture, you guys. Just have a look at the picture. And in that picture, what you have is Krakoa looking really big. You get a full sense of the scale and the small characters around him. And also, there's this chaos of all of the different beams and energies coming out of them. And so this is where all of the heroes are trying their different approaches to fighting this monster, and none of them are meshing. And so where the comics design really comes in is you imagine yourself reading this book, and you get to the end of this page, and Professor X says, "What are you fools doing? This isn't going to work. I have a plan, an orderly plan." And so then you turn to the next page, and it's symmetrical. You have these balanced boxes in the center. You have Professor X mentally facing off against Krakoa on the other side. And you have Storm at the top, Lauren and Dane at the bottom, and that sets up their vertical partnership, and everything just becomes a lot more orderly, except for the fight between Cyclops and his brother there. But just that transition between a chaos that words cannot describe to this orderly thing, to everyone following Professor X's plan, I think that's a central part of this comic. And how does that sound to you guys? And did you notice anything from these pages from me making that?
No, but I wouldn't say that the conversation between Cyclops and Havok brings you out of that. I mean, look, there's a symmetry to those two panels. That's if you look, they kind of switch.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, they get closer, but it's much more subtle, but you know, I noticed some symmetry there too. So, no, I think that's pretty awesome.
Absolutely. I'm not going to lie to you. I'd not even noticed the structure of those pages. So brilliant catch with it. I think, to me, the Cyclops and Havok conversation strikes as just a hint that the discord is still there, even in the structure, even in the plans being followed. It hints at the idea of cost. So in this case, it's Havok's reacting to, "You've got to call it off, Scott, with Lorna is hurt." This is pushing her too far, is the idea. So it's quite an interesting counterplay to the structure of the page as a whole.
Yeah, and sort of a central part of the plot. I think Justin and I were talking before, and I sort of felt that the message was a bit all over the place, because Professor X promises something different to each team member that he's recruiting, and in some cases, the things that he promises are actually opposite each other. So for me, the one clear message that I get from Giant Size X-Men is that we all are more effective at whatever the goal might be when we work as an organized unit.
I think Nightcrawler is the one, again, just circling around again, he's one that interests me the most. I mean, I've always had a soft spot for him. Yeah. And not just because he's one of the coolest parts of all the X-Men movies, but I've always thought Nightcrawler was such a wonderful character. When I read Nightcrawler, he doesn't strike me, oddly enough, as a Catholic. He reminds me more of Lutheran style.
Yeah, I remember
and
you telling me, yeah.
Again, that's a nod all the way back, because Luther, of course, was in that area of Europe at the time. And so I think that's a deliberate homage there, tapping into that much deeper sense of history. I think that's what, at times, the comic was trying to do, to tap into the history of a people and a place. Unfortunately, the writers didn't always know that history particularly well. And quite frankly, they only had so many hours of the day, and this was before the internet.
We talked about Krakoa and its significance and the Gaia hypothesis and stuff, but moving on to that portion of the story, and we've talked about this before a little bit, but I was taken aback by how the X-Men treated each other, how Thunderbird treated Cyclops, how Sunfire treated everyone. I mean, it was shocking. Although they did work together as a team, and although they did make it work, they did not have the grace with which the original X-Men had, or the Fantastic Four, or other teams. You know, they were they got the job done, but it was kind of a mess. No one listened to each other. Cyclops had a hard time leading the team, and
yes.
You know, it's, they get through it, but and they get through by the skin of their teeth. But it's a rocky road, to say the least.
Yes, I think this is where the X-Men really changed their style, because when I first got into comics, I remember comparing the X-Men to a soap. The equivalent of, I don't know what the American version is, but in England we have Coronation Street, EastEnders and Emmerdale, where everything is about love and drama and anger and fits of rage against one another.
Yes, yes, yes.
And half of the narrative is about the interaction of the characters. And I think that's where the X-Men first, where that whole aspect of the X-Men first started, because these were suddenly characters who were in collision with one another. And so you have the classic image of X-Man against X-Man. This seemed to spend half of their superheroic career beating each other up.
Right.
And it's all because they're 3D characters, and the characters have conflict, and that conflict needs to be confronted, sometimes resolved, and when it's resolved, it needs to lead to the next conflict. It all flows on. And I do think Giant Size X-Men started that, because it brought these characters together in such a combative way, such an awkward fit, that suddenly the writers realized, from a dramatic point of view, this was fun.
Yeah. That's a good way of looking at it. I do love the close reading that Kathy did, because it's so hysterically funny to me that they're like, mere words could not even begin to describe the sheer unbridled savagery of the battle that follows, so we won't even attempt it here. You know, it's like, okay. Like, I guess, you know, I after shows like Game of Thrones and stuff in the 2010s, it's hard to, you know, look at a panel with Storm and Sunfire shooting their different beams at Krakoa and thinking of it as unbridled savagery. But you know, it's cool.
Very true. Society has moved on.
Yeah, it feels like a little bit of a cop out to me. You know, I was like, explain it, damn it, tell me. But they refused to do it, you know, and I was very upset about that.
I do recommend, again, like I mentioned, there was a novel of this, a novelization in the 90s, and there they do indeed describe it.
All right, I thought graphic novel.
No.
Okay.
It was a full-on, written-out text version.
Wow. Okay, pretty cool. And I do love this panel that Kathy talks about that's very symmetrical with Storm and Lorna. And pretty cool the way Lorna gets her powers back. And it's interesting to me that Lorna is the person who sort of saves everybody at the end.
Yes.
And you know, you and I are both big Lorna Dane fans, so...
Absolutely.
It's the art is amazing, and it's apropos that she's the one who saves them. But and we shouldn't talk about this maybe so much, but this is all kind of retcon later, isn't it?
Yes, this whole thing is completely rewritten. I'm not entirely sure how well the continuity of Ed Brubaker's Deadly Genesis works, quite frankly. But Brubaker established that Xavier had first sent in another team, the most famous of which is Vulcan, but also mm-hmm. Darwin, who even arrived in on the big screen.
Oh,
in
I love Darwin, yeah. Yeah.
This team was sent in, and they died. So Xavier then collected a whole new team, the one that we've got in this comic. Worse, though, Brubaker then established that Krakoa was never sentient and never spoke or anything like that. That all those things were actually Xavier mentally projecting to cover his tracks, so to speak. It's quite a dark concept, really, that Xavier would deceive to that insane a level. As well, though, when you look back at it, Krakoas appeared again in comics. In the 90s, they did an appearance in the Generation X comics very briefly.
Mm-hmm.
And Jason Aaron's used them recently as well. Personally, I'm not...
Peter David in X-Factor.
Sorry?
Peter David in X-Factor as well.
Yeah, but the point I'd make is I don't think that Deadly Genesis really fits with the broader depiction of Krakoa.
Yes, I agree.
And that's my problem I have with it. It doesn't fit at all. I think it was an attempt to force something into continuity. When you compare that to the other retcon that I mentioned, Original Sin, mm-hmm. with Wolverine, it revealed that he'd actually joined in order to kill Xavier. When you read that comic, it's done with subtlety and care. Deadly Genesis was like a sledgehammer.
Yes.
And as a result, Deadly Genesis, I just don't like it. The annoying bit is that Deadly Genesis does introduce some concepts I love. Vulcan goes on to be part of some massive arcs.
Mm-hmm.
Rise and Fall of the Shi'ar Empire is one of my all-time favorite X-Men comics.
Me too, it's great, yeah.
And without Deadly Genesis, he wouldn't be on the scene.
Very
true. It's just a shame that the setup is so bad, in my view.
I actually love the characters that they came up with during Deadly Genesis. I love Petra. Yes. I love Sway. I love Darwin. Sway. And Vulcan. Yes. You know, they're all wonderful characters. And what I like about them is that they're like the original seven X-Men, the original five, you know, who become the seven. And they're from the Tri-State area of New York City, the metropolitan area of New York City. And they're similar to Jean Grey and Warren Worthington and Bobby Drake. And I think that that's cool because it gave homage to how international this giant size X-Men was. And it said,
didn't damage the wonder of the giant.
Exactly. Exactly. I really, really liked that. And So in closing, what do you have to say about this comic, Giant Size X-Men 1?
The first thing I'd say is read it. It's one of the single comics that's had the most impact on comic book history, without a doubt. It's a comic that introduced so many core elements of the X-Men franchise, characters who we got to know and love over the years. Everybody talks about the Claremont era, but the reality is Claremont built on this foundation. If he hadn't had this foundation to build upon, we wouldn't have had anything as brilliant as we have. To me, this is one of the heroes of the whole X-Men range.
I think it's such an important comic for new readers to read. It's not going to change your life in terms of the writing style, but it will introduce you to these characters and show you where they started, and it makes you care about them and where they are now in a way that would happen in a way that wouldn't happen if you didn't read this. So, you know, I definitely recommend it as well. I always get so shocked when I'm like, when people haven't read it.
Yeah. I think it's a comic that ironically it's easy to overlook nowadays because we've gotten so caught up in the new issues and new releases that I think it's not stressed enough that it's useful to go back. I mean, there was a time when all of these older stories were constantly being reprinted, but they aren't anymore.
Yeah.
And so I do think the modern comic book audience is almost divorced from the history and the heritage of what they're reading. At times, that's useful for Marvel because it means they can move things on without causing too much of a problem. But it's also damaging because you don't realize the depth of the characters and you really lose something.
Slightly disagree with Kathy. I get that she says the message was all over the place, but to me, I was just struck by what it meant to be normal and how you need to rise above normal. And normal is not necessarily a great thing. And not only is it okay to be different, these differences need to be celebrated. And not only is it okay to be different, maybe you're special, you know? And I think that when a kid who doesn't feel like they are good enough reads this comic book, it makes them feel better and it makes them think differently and it gives them hope. And what more could you ask for, you know?
Absolutely.
And what more of a beautiful thing could there be than to do that? So when you're a kid, it's going to do that for you. I mean, if you're reading this book at 35, I don't know if it's going to have the same effect, but you know, it's worth a shot, and it's worth it reading at 35 so that you can have that background that we talked about. And that's what I would say in closing for me. So definitely pick up this book. I want to thank Tom so much for being a part of this podcast. I know it's his first podcast, so thank you, Tom. Everyone else had to go. Kathy had to go. Josh White couldn't make it, unfortunately, but we will be back in a few weeks with part two. Not part two, but with a brand new podcast about the X-Men. So, like we said earlier, we need a name, right? I mean, we can't keep doing this without a name. So, info@comicsverse.com. Email us a name @comicsverse@twitter. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/comicsverse. Find us. Let us know what you think. You know, we want to have a cool and interesting name. And, you know, we want to keep bringing you this in-depth analytical speak about comics that isn't really done anywhere else. So, do that.
And bonus points if your name has X's that we can capitalize in it.
Oh, hell yeah. It should definitely have X's. It should have two X's. All right, Tom, thank you so much. And thank you, Kathy, for that amazing close reading. And we will see you soon.